Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. My next News and Comment podcast will be on Monday, February 9th. I'm taking a break to lead some podcasting workshops in Oregon. Will oil become a weapon of peace? Will the Saudis be able to persuade the Russians to back off their support of the Assad government in Syria by offering to prop up world oil prices? Well, ever since we've seen the price of oil drop, and for me, this goes back to September, I was traveling in Asia and I read the Jakarta Post, which indicated for the first time that I had seen that there was a developing glut in world crude oil supplies. And over the past few months, we've seen the price of crude drop precipitously. It's in the $42 a barrel range. It was up to 100 and a quarter or so. And we've seen the retail price of gasoline drop. It's back up a little bit in California, and I don't know why. The lowest price I paid to fill up my car was $2.09 for, you know, the lowest level of unleaded. And now it's up to $2.15 or $2.19, and I'm not really sure why. But as this developed, I've had my suspicions. Why would the Saudis continue to pump massive amounts of oil against a declining price? The history is clear that the Saudis and OPEC over the years responded to oversupply and dropping prices by cutting production. And so I've been suspicious that this was part of some scheme aimed at Russia and other countries whose budgets are inordinately dependent on exporting crude oil at high prices. And here's some evidence today in the New York Times. Dateline Washington, Saudi oil seen as lever to pry Russia away from Syria's Assad. And they quote a Saudi diplomat, "If oil can serve to bring peace in Syria, I don't see how Saudi Arabia would back away from trying to reach a deal." Now that puts a positive spin on these cutthroat backroom deals that are being attempted right now. And I would be surprised if Putin allows any kind of pressure or leverage that would separate him from his support of the Assad government. I'll be very surprised if that goal is achieved. But that's what is described here. Any weakening of Russian support for Assad could be one of the first signs that the recent tumult in the oil market is having an impact on global statecraft. But is it the other way around, that global statecraft, not market conditions, is what has caused this crash in the energy industry worldwide? Syria was a major topic, the Times says, for a Saudi delegation that went to Moscow in November. There's been steady dialogue between the two countries, and it's not clear whether the death last week, or January 23rd, of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia might have impacted. But it's interesting to read here. Its refusal, this is the Saudi, its refusal to support such steps to limit production, despite dizzying price declines, has prompted myriad theories about the Saudi royal family's agenda. And Saudi officials have hinted that the country's happy to let the low prices punish rival producers who use more expensive shale fracking techniques. Now, that's the other fallout from these lower prices, that the expanded production in the U.S., at great risk to the environment and to climate change factors, is now hammered. We're seeing the frackers and the shale oil operators scramble, and the big oil companies are reporting losses. Curiously, the airlines, while they're enjoying a break in the cost of fuel, are not passing that along to the flying population, partly because they've lost money on hedge strategies that never anticipated that the price of crude and the price of jet fuel would drop so far, so fast. And so this creates some unpredictable scenarios. But it is if it is driven at least in part by geopolitical considerations, it's a very high-risk strategy to take the world to the brink of recession. The unknown consequences of these changes in the oil markets. So we'll continue to pursue this, and I offer this as a theory for your consideration. I'm not arguing that there is substantial proof of this kind of manipulation of the markets, but I think it's highly possible, and I'd love to hear your feedback. Why don't you send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Now, those falling oil prices have caused the Environmental Protection Agency to issue a new report, which could strengthen the hand of President Obama in vetoing the legislation which would force passage or approval of the Keystone XL pipeline route. Now, in a letter to the State Department, the EPA said the recent drop in oil prices means that Keystone would indeed promote further expansion of Alberta tar sands, unleashing more greenhouse gas emissions and worsening climate change. And one of the key assumptions in last year's State Department report on Keystone no longer holds because falling oil prices make it less likely that producers would pay the higher costs of shipping crude oil by rail. That was one of the arguments offered. Look, this shale oil from Alberta, from the north slope of the United States, North Dakota, it's going to find its way to the market anyway. It will seep to market. So just get over it, and we're just supposed to sit back and accept it. And Bill McKibben, the inspiring guy from Vermont who founded 350.org and has been driving the Keystone protest, he said, as of today, the president has all the nails that he needs to close the lid on this particular boondoggle of a coffin. Well, we will see. We will see. Well, just when you thought the Islamic State had run out of barbaric practices to use in propaganda videos to rile Americans, oh, they have found a new way. We now know the fate of the Jordanian pilot who was captured at the end of December, First Lieutenant Moaz al-Kasaspa. He was killed standing inside a cage, and he was burned alive when an unidentified militant torched some ignited flammable liquid, likely gasoline, that had drenched the pilot's orange jumpsuit. And curiously, the New York Times quotes David Phillips, former senior advisor to the State Department, now at Columbia University, quote, they have raised the bar in terms of brutality. Raised? I believe this lowers the bar. And there's no doubt in my mind that these theatrically staged videos are carefully crafted. And they are trying to send a message to Americans, and most Americans don't get it. The orange jumpsuit is a reference to Guantanamo, to Abu Ghraib, to the black sites. They are tweaking us. This could be drawn from some Muslim who read a Bible and said, oh yeah, they used to burn Christians at the stake. And this is payback for America's trip to the dark side, as Dick Cheney put it. And yet, we rarely recognize our role in these types of responses. Now, the upshot is it's possible that he may have been killed on January 3rd. They're trying to track down the actual date that the video was shot. And if that's the case, it means that Jordan has been through a protracted process of humiliation. Because, as we told you last week, they carefully staged these protests by the family of the captured pilot. And the king said, you know, in response to this public pressure, he was willing to trade Sajida Rishawa, an Iraqi woman who's held in Jordan jails, for a 2005 bombing attack in Amman. And so by exposing itself as willing to negotiate, willing to trade hostage for hostage, only to see the deal unravel with the death of their pilot, and that the whole thing may have been a ruse that he's been dead for over a month. Today, in an in-depth interview released to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com, we go in-depth on last week's conviction of former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling, 9 counts under the Espionage Act. And I turn to two people I highly respect. Gareth Porter is an expert on Iran's nuclear programs. And he is one of the few people who argues that Iran has not been pursuing a nuclear weapon for the last 10 years or more. And Norman Solomon is a longtime author and activist who wrote the book War Made Easy. And he covered the trial and wrote about it frequently at exposedfacts.org. In this excerpt from our in-depth conversation about the conviction of Jeffrey Sterling, Norman Solomon wrestles with the question, why did the Obama administration, years after this case originated, and Sterling was accused during the Bush administration, and this is the case that drew in James Risen, the New York Times journalist, and attempted to force him to testify, why did the government go to such great lengths to indict and convict Jeffrey Sterling?
Many reasons, and as you allude to, similar or parallel to why it had subpoena after subpoena continued against James Risen, demanding that he rat on his sources under penalty of going potentially to jail. For one thing, the administration changed from Bush to Obama, but the mentality didn't. And arguably in this area, it got significantly worse. So you had this sort of crusade continuing to show journalists that James Risen was not going to get away with this. And it was sort of doubled down at the trial itself because Risen had been able to get beyond the long arm of the law, but Sterling was in the crosshairs. And they wanted to, and legally did, crush and demolish Sterling, both to teach him a lesson, but far more significantly to teach a lesson to anybody inside the CIA, DIA, FBI, NSA, or elsewhere, the so-called intelligence community, that this is what would happen to them if they would act on any impulse of conscience or believing in the informed consent of the governed.
You can hear the full conversation. It's just under an hour with Norman Solomon and Gareth Porter about the Jeffrey Sterling case. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And subscribers include great people like Andy Betmanis, Terry Paris, Teresa Phillips, just renewed her annual subscription, as did Linda Clark. Thank you, one and all. I appreciate your support. I need more people to support me, so come on over to peterbcollins.com, and why don't you start a subscription of your own? You click on the link that says sign up. It's right under my picture on the homepage. You can choose from $5, $10, $20 a month. Our best deal is that $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers anywhere in the world earn a bonus gift from me. It's an ebook copy of Pepe Escobar's newest book called Empire of Chaos, and it's a great read. I'd love to send it to you. As you know, I care a lot about the creeping police state, the surveillance state in the U.S., and I was talking to NSA whistleblowers long before Ed Snowden surfaced. We have serious problems, constitutional violations on a massive scale. And today, James Clapper, who is the proven perjurer and top spook who runs the Office of National Intelligence, served up a very limited list of minor modifications to the surveillance schemes. And this appears to be in advance of a trip by German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who, of course, is still upset that we were monitoring her cell phone and conducting espionage against an ally, the nation of Germany. So, you know, this is mostly meaningless, and this is primarily double talk aimed at public relations gains. For example, this new announced set of policies places a limit, or it purports to, on how long our personal data that is gathered can be held. Now, this is limited to non-U.S. citizens. And Clapper is saying that under the new policy, they will not hold data for longer than 5 years. But let me explain that up until 2012, the policy was they would purge all information every 6 months. And that was quietly and unilaterally extended to 5 years by officials in the Obama administration. So they are acting like this is an improvement, when in fact, they're just locking in the modified status quo. Also, the report doesn't appear to address the role of telecommunications companies in holding the telephone records, the metadata. And I want to underscore that in the Jeffrey Sterling CIA conviction, the case was circumstantial. All they had was proof that there were phone calls between Sterling and James Risen, a total of less than 5 minutes of phone calls on some 7 different attempts to talk. They didn't have intercepts of the actual content of those calls, just the fact that the calls were made. And that metadata is one of the elements, very flimsy elements, that led to the jury conviction of Jeffrey Sterling. So please understand that when people say to you, "Oh, I don't care if they have my phone records, I don't have anything to hide." Well, it's very powerful information, and it can be used and abused. Now, the one good thing announced here is that there is a rollback of the Patriot Act powers that allow the FBI to issue their own warrants called national security letters that include a gag order, an unlimited gag order. And now they're saying that the gag orders can't last longer than 3 years. That's still ridiculous, but it's better than having no expiration on those widely abused national security letters. Now, despite all this, the White House says that this highlights substantial progress and reflects an ongoing commitment to greater transparency. And to that, my response is bullshit. There is no way to dress this up. This government has expanded violations of our constitutional rights to privacy beyond anything ever contemplated. And yet they tell us that they're really vigilant about our constitutional rights and our privacy rights. I'm sorry, it's simply not true. Well, there is a little bit of a scandal brewing in England that was triggered by a comment last week that Colin Powell's outspoken former chief of staff, Larry Wilkerson, made, which confirmed that the U.S. used a British facility in the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean as a CIA black site. And presumably, people were held there and tortured there. And what this has produced is pushback in England because the Senate Intelligence Committee's review of CIA torture, rendition, and detention didn't make any mention of Diego Garcia or a role of any kind by the United Kingdom. And now we know that the British ambassador to the U.S. met members of the Senate Intelligence Committee 11 times during the period after the report was finished, but before it was ultimately released and all this backroom wrangling was going on what to eliminate from the report. And the Parliament in Britain has an Intelligence and Security Committee, and it is saying that they're conducting an investigation to see whether British officials were complicit in torture overseas. And one of the key cases is one that I have followed, this fellow Abdel Hakim Belhaj, a Libyan, not suspected of any terrorism. But he was picked up by the United States and apparently held by Britain at some point before he was turned over to the Gaddafi government in his native country of Libya, where he was held and tortured. And so we trafficked Belhaj. We used him as some sort of diplomatic currency. We took a human being and, with the help of the British, delivered him to this brutal dictator that we later decided we had to take out in Libya. And we should know a lot more about that. That's a real deep violation of American standards and policies. Well, the Pentagon has backed off a little bit on the attempt to declare classified information that was routinely published about the war in Afghanistan up until last month. The Inspector General's data regarding the Afghan forces is no longer going to be declared classified. But they're not releasing all of the data that they used to release, and this is just another move by the most transparent administration in American history, it claims, to cover up and prevent us from finding out what's really going on. And we learned today that the Pentagon can't trace hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons that were delivered to the government in Yemen. $400 million worth of helicopters, night vision gear. We've given them a few drones, surveillance equipment, military radios, transport aircraft. And because our puppet government fell there recently, the Hadi government, the Houthi tribes from the northern part of Yemen are now controlling the capital, and we're told they control the military's arms depots and bases. And so here we have another case where we have armed people who at one point were our allies. And now opponents have taken over. And just like it happened in Iraq, where, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of gear that we gave to the Iraqi military are now in the hands of the Islamic State. We continue to compound our errors by saying that we're going to provide arms like this to so-called moderates in Syria. This is so mind-bogglingly crazy. And just to show them who's who, we killed four people in Yemen Monday with another drone strike. Just to, you know, add a little chaos to an unstable situation. Today, the Department of Justice announced a settlement with Standard & Poor's. That is the rating agency that enabled the racketeers with their mortgage-backed securities to destabilize, almost kill the American economy in 2008. And true to form, Eric Holder is still there at the Justice Department. His replacement has not been confirmed yet. And once again, he is obstructing justice, he's protecting the guilty, and he's allowing Standard & Poor's to get away by paying $1.5 billion. And here's a quote from Bob Weissman at Public Citizen. He says, "The statement of facts in this settlement shows not that the company made good faith mistakes in the run-up to the financial crash, but that it compromised its independence and deceived investors. Yet today, S&P settles without even an admission that it violated the law and with no prospect of subsequent criminal prosecution." You remember when Carl Levin got that, I think it was a Goldman Sachs guy, to talk about the shitty deals? So they knew that they were putting toxic mortgages bundled together with good mortgages and selling them off with ratings supplied by people like Standard & Poor's, that these are all AAA, gold-plated, you know, no worries. You just can buy this and sleep well at night. Well, they committed fraud at some point. And yet this administration, let's remember that Barack Obama in the early goings in 2008 got his first big money from Wall Street. And it appears he's very loyal to the folks who paved his way to the White House. And it's just so sad to see that there will be no accountability. And these people will collect bonuses and continue their white-collar criminal behavior until the next crash, when we will bail them out again. So here in California, we've had an outbreak of the measles. It started at Disneyland, and there are now 100 cases in the Bay Area. And it's prompted a lot of people to look at the parents who opt out of vaccinating their children. And I have to tell you that I have conflicting feelings about this. Now, as a kid, I was vaccinated for polio and for measles and smallpox, all kinds of things. However, children today are, you know, if they do everything that the doctors recommend, they submit to some 28 vaccinations in the first 5 years of life. And while immunologists make a strong case that vaccinations protect large populations, I understand the parents who say, you know, I just can't force this on my child. And while I accept the science that vaccination is not directly linked to autism, I have to tell you that I've heard anecdotal cases of parents who say, my kid was fine, then she got a vaccination, and now she's got this. And so I, you can tell, I have very mixed feelings about this. And last night I was watching Rachel Maddow on MSDNC, and she was taking great pleasure in serving up sound bites from Chris Christie, who's on a campaign trip to London to get some photo ops. And he was quoted as saying that parents need to have some measure of choice about vaccinating their children. And then Rand Paul, who's an ophthalmologist, not, you know, an internist, was quoted as making a statement, while I think it's a good idea to take the vaccine, I think that's a personal decision for individuals. Now, what I didn't know is that polling has shifted on this question, and that in 2009, it was fairly equal, that 71% of both Republicans and Democrats favored requiring vaccination of children. But now, Democratic support has grown by 5 points, and Republican support has fallen by 6 points. And there's now a 9-point spread between Democrats and Republicans on the vaccination question. But this article notes the debate does not break entirely along right-left lines. The movement to forego vaccinations has been popular in more liberal and affluent communities. Yeah, here in Marin County, California, we have pockets of some schools where almost half of the kids have not been vaccinated. Now, I understand the issues. I also understand that the risk is primarily borne by those who are not vaccinated. And I was reading about this online, and somebody raised the point, if measles vaccines confer measles immunity, then why do already vaccinated children have anything to fear from a measles outbreak? And I can't argue with the logic of that question. And so, yes, there's some parents who are taking a risk by not immunizing their kids. But like Christian scientists who don't go to doctors, isn't that one of the freedoms that we offer here in this country? And I really reject Rachel Maddow's attempt to confer conspiracy theory status on people who have honest questions about vaccinating their kids. So there. You want to share your point of view? I'd love to hear it. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com. A couple of quickies here. In San Diego, a jury has found a man guilty of 12 felony counts for running a revenge porn website. Kevin Bollart, he ran YouGotPosted.com, a site where pictures were posted of women without their consent, usually by jilted ex-boyfriends, along with the women's names and other personal details, sometimes including phone numbers. That's pretty rude and invasive. And then, getting into the extortion game, he ran a separate site called ChangeMyReputation.com, where women who paid money could have their photos and personal data removed. Now, that's a shakedown. That is a crime. And Bullard, who used the screen name Vindictive, hosted more than 10,000 explicit sexual photos on the site, netting him thousands of dollars in profit. Now, it's interesting because his prosecution was brought following California's new anti-revenge porn law, which was signed by Governor Brown in October of 13. But since the new law targets only those who actually take the pictures, Bollert was not convicted under it. Instead, he was found guilty on felony charges of identity theft and, properly, extortion. And finally today, a little good news coming from Vatican City. Pope Francis has decreed today that the slain Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was killed in 1980, is being declared a martyr. And that sets the stage for eventual sainthood for Archbishop Romero. Now, as a fallen away Catholic, I don't take the religious aspects of this that seriously. But the political and historical implications here are significant. Now, maybe you don't remember, but Oscar Romero was the Archbishop of San Salvador, and he was gunned down by right-wing death squads, possibly with support from the United States, in 1980 while he was saying Mass. Romero had spoken out against repression by the Salvadoran army at the beginning of the Civil War, where the U.S. took the side of the so-called Contras. And that battle led to the deaths of 75,000 people. Now, Romero advanced what was called liberation theology, which challenged the role of the Catholic Church in propping up dictatorships, particularly in Latin America. And that's why I consider him a significant political figure. And in a quote I have here from a former Maryknoll priest, Blaise Bonpain, he said, "The Pope is really taking a slam on John Paul II, his predecessor, who forced Romero to wait for weeks in Rome and wouldn't talk to him when Romero was desperately trying to explain the situation in El Salvador. And John Paul II, coming from Poland, was blinded by his anti-communism. And with the support of Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Benedict, Pope Benedict, well, Ratzinger was the enforcer." And this former priest says, "That's the reason why I left the clergy. I was told to shut up and forget everything I learned about Latin America and to go to Hawaii. Ratzinger was the enforcer against liberation theology, which Romero had embraced." So, that's a little bit of progress toward justice and correcting the historical record. And it's another reason why I think Pope Francis is still, you know, an authoritarian Catholic, but pretty much the coolest pope we've had since John the 23rd. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast you're invited to share with absolutely everyone. I'll be back in your ears Monday, February 9th.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.